This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up now that spring is here, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. So what's the right amount of socializing for you? Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. It's a great way to build relationship skills, figure out your goals, and so much more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/beherenow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/beherenow.
After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nickturn and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nickturn and Duncan Trussell.
Welcome to the Be Here Now Network guest podcast. This series features talks from a myriad of modern spiritual teachers expanding on how we can all live a life in balance. If you're interested in supporting this podcast, please go to beherenownetwork.com/guest.
It has been said that there are 84,000 Dharma doors, meaning doors that you could walk through to become free. And the idea that there's so many, and 84,000 means, you know, almost uncountable numbers, is that there are different doors for different people. And what I'm going to talk about tonight is the door of dependent origination, which is sometimes considered to be one of the profound doors, profound teachings of Buddhism. And maybe it'll be a door for some of you, and maybe for others of you it won't be a door. If it is not a door, don't worry. There's more doors. My mother, when I was growing up, my mother said, well, I don't know if I should say this. Well, I'll modify it. She said something like, don't run after the bus. There's always another one coming. So there's more doors coming. So dependent origination. Guy pointed out, is a very close connection between dependent origination and emptiness. And even more so in Mahayana, because of the teachings of Mahayana Buddhism, puts almost primary emphasis to explain emptiness from the point of view of what's called dependent origination, conditioned arising, dependent co-arising. And so much so that one of the quotes here is, what is dependently arisen, that is what we understand by emptiness. The famous Mahayana philosopher Nagarjuna. So equating the two together. So emptiness as being dependently, pointing to what's dependently arisen. So one of the implications of this idea is that in this kind of teaching of dependent origination, emptiness and dependent origination are not distinct. Or say it differently, that emptiness is a characteristic of the things, of some things. So the characteristic of water is that it's wet. And you kind of don't separate water and wetness, they kind of come together. A cloud is impermanent. Or a river is impermanent, just flowing. And you don't separate out the impermanence, you know, you can't take it out, the permanence from the river. It's just a characteristic of a river. It's constantly changing and flowing. And so emptiness in this teaching of dependent origination is a characteristic or a quality or an aspect of some things. So it's not negating that things exist. It's just explaining how they exist, the way that they exist. And they say, it said that they exist in an empty way. And so that's what the topic for today is. What does this mean, that they're empty? So it's not negating that things exist. It's negating something about some quality of them, some characteristic of them. So, for example, I can ring the bell. You can hear the sound. And that sound is empty of material substance. The sound is empty material substance. The sound, I don't think, has a weight. It's empty of weight. It's empty of substance. So it's a characteristic of the sound to have that kind of emptiness. And there's many things in our life which we appreciate when they're empty. Water, which is empty of impurities, is clean. Someone whose conscience is empty would be someone who is not troubled by anything, I think. The air, when it's clean, empty of smog and dust, it kind of feels good to look out across the terrain and see the clear skies, clear air. An empty hand is sometimes very meaningful. Sometimes it's very painful. You ended up empty-handed. But to come with an empty hand, to be open-handed. When's a hand open and when's a hand empty? It's kind of like you have to be empty to be open-handed and have a hand that's useful. There's a beautiful quote from a Christian theologian named Henry Nouwen that touches on the value of emptiness, being empty. The quote starts with this beautiful, I think, little phrase. We are all healers. Isn't that nice? We're all healers. And he's writing this kind of for chaplains, or people who offer spiritual care. We are all healers who can reach out to offer help. And we are all patients in constant need of help. He says a variety of things, but the quote I wanted to read, he says, therefore, healing means, first of all, the creation of an empty but friendly space where those who suffer can tell their story to someone who can listen with real attention. So to create an empty space, not be so full of yourself when you go talk to someone who's helping, you're going to help, but to be empty enough to listen and hear them and hear them out. And have that ability to empty yourself. And I think many of you probably value coming on retreat for the way in which it empties out a lot of the momentum and concerns and preoccupations of your heart and mind, a lot of the kind of residue that's left from our way we live our life has a chance to settle out in a certain kind of emptiness. And that emptiness, emptying, sometimes it's almost synonymous with the word free. The water, which is empty of impurities, is free of impurities. A window, which I guess it wouldn't work for window, but the air, which is empty of smog, is free of smog. A heart, which is free of suffering, is empty of suffering. A mind, which is free of anxiety, is empty of anxiety. So there's a way of understanding it's empty, what's empty, as being very meaningful. And one of the things about being empty is that it allows for new possibilities. And so how do we get empty to make space for something to happen? What's the value of being empty? And what are the problems of not being empty? Why did the Buddhist tradition put such strong emphasis on things, should be seen as being empty as opposed to being some other way? So the teachings on dependent origination point to this, and the ancient tradition explains, has a story, that the Buddha's foremost disciple, Sariputta, was a spiritual seeker in his time, hadn't met the Buddha, but he met one of the Buddha's monks. And the Buddha's monk, and he asked this monk, what does your teacher teach? And the monk said, I'm not really qualified. And so he asked, please let me know. Let me be the one to decide. If it's meaningful, I'll get it. And so this monk then gave this very short teaching, which is a teaching on dependent origination. So of those things which arise from a cause, the Tathagata has taught that cause and also their cessation. Such is the teachings of the great teacher. With that little statement, Sariputta understood something so profound that his life was never the same again. And he then went and found the Buddha and was ordained and became a Buddhist monk and continued his practice until he became fully enlightened. There's something about this little saying which can seem so ridiculous to say, that he kind of got it. Of those things which arise from a cause, the Tathagata has taught the cause and also their cessation. And that's, again, the topic of dependent origination that today is going to kind of focus. Why is this statement so profound that Sariputta kind of, in a certain kind of way, woke up, changed his life? So, so how do things exist is also part of what dependent origination tries to explain. Do we understand how they exist? So if I give an example of making a fist. And now a fist is useful for some things. And if I get angry with you, it might be useful to scare you away. It might be useful for having a temper tantrum. It might be useful for, I don't know what, but I'm sure it has other uses as well, to have a fist. But it's pretty limited what this hand can do if it stays in a fist. Now this fist, what's the nature of its existence? How does it exist? Does it exist in some absolute eternal way? Is it a really existing thing? If you say it is, then I open my hand. What happened to the fist? The eternal existing solid thing. Can you find the fist now? It's gone. So if you say that it really exists, I go like that, it disappears. It doesn't really exist. If you say it doesn't exist, and if I was, a Zen master, I'd probably tap you gently to make a point. It does have a certain kind of existence, and it has a certain kind of non-existence. Existence and non-existence doesn't really accurately speak or say what this nature of the fist is, the existence of this fist. The fist doesn't really exist exactly. It exists temporarily because certain things are happening. Certain things have come together. I've tightened up the muscles in my hands and my forearm to pull those fingers in. And I want to do it. So there has to be a thought in my mind that says, tighten up, the muscles oblige. And if I make a really hard fist, I have to continue to remind myself, keep it tight. Because the natural tendency is that kind of that activity is to stop the activity, to relax and open up. So the existence of this fist exists in part on these conditions. It's that I want to tighten up and make a fist, and my muscles tighten up. If I stop wanting to have a tight fist, stop sending those signals into my hand, and stop tightening up my muscles, then the fist opens up. I like this analogy of a fist because you can explain some other things as well. And that is, once the hand is open, the open hand is useful for a lot more things. An open, empty hand can be used for picking up a tool, for shaking a hand, for caressing a child. It can be used for, the hand, the inner hand is quite sensitive compared to the outer part of the hand. So this heightened sensitive part of who we are is available to the world and to sense. We can do a lot of things. We can help people with an open hand. It's for many people, it's the first contact they have when they get born, besides the contact with their mother, is someone's hands receiving them and taking them, kind of touching, the contact we have with hands, what we can do. I think that if the midwife, was going to only had a fist, we would come into a different world. So to be able to release the fist. So the same thing is true for our hearts and our minds. That if we keep ourselves knotted up, caught up, if we keep ourselves attached to things, it might have some use. And maybe once upon a time it was useful. And I would venture to say that we don't try to get attached and hold on unless we think it's useful. Something thinks it's useful to protect ourselves, to get what we want, to do something. Maybe once upon a time it was. But to go around chronically knotted up, fisted up in the mind or the heart, limits us dramatically from what, all the other things we can do with an open heart, an open mind. And the most sensitive parts of who we are found in that openness, not in the clutching and that goes on. So then the question is, like the fist, are there conditions that are behind the clutching of the heart and the mind? Are there things that it arises in dependence on? And so, so it could be that I'm all closed down because I'm afraid. So independence, dependent on my fear, I close my heart. So then the idea would go that if you realize that fear is what keeps the heart closed, then perhaps it's useful to deal with the fear and the heart can open. It's probably not so useful to bypass that. So, I don't know if this is a good example, but sometimes it's definitely useful to get a massage and relax nicely. But doing that relaxes from the outside in. When you sit in meditation and sit and feel your tension, then there's a chance sometimes of doing that relaxation from the inside out. So if you're tense because you're afraid, the massage might give you relief, but it might not address your fear. But if you sit quietly and feel and enter into the inside and really feel what's going on deeply inside, you might become aware of the fear and maybe address it and resolve it. If you do it from the outside in, you might get relief, but the underlying condition for tension has not been addressed. And so then, the massage wears off and, you can be tighten up again. But if you go from the inside out and address the underlying condition, then maybe you have a chance of not repeating the same patterns of fear and tension closing down that might happen. So the teachings of dependent origination are the teachings that our suffering, the ways that we suffer, is not an eternally existing thing. It's not a fixed thing. And it isn't that it, and it, we don't want to say that suffering exists absolutely, but we don't want to say that it doesn't exist either. Anybody who hurts knows that. I've had people into them kind of a certain kind of over the top idealistic emptiness philosophy will look at me and they'd say, you know, your suffering is empty. You know, like just, you know, there's no suffering basically. Ouch. Now I hurt more. Yes, it's empty, but you know, it hurts. So, you know, does it exist? Does it not exist? Does my suffering really exist? Does my suffering not exist? That's not the question that is interesting. What's interesting from the Buddhist point of view is what's the condition that out of which originates the suffering. So if it's tension or closed heart because you're afraid, then the fear would be that condition. If it's tremendous disappointment in something, and the condition for that was greed, then rather than dealing with disappointment, maybe it's more significant to deal with the greed underlying it. So there's a whole, all suffering, according to the Buddhist teachings, has a condition for its arising. We don't get born with suffering, exactly. It's something that we, you know, there's a doing, there's an activity that we're involved in. So suffering is part of a chain of activity. It's a process. It's not fixed. And this is supposed to be the good news in Buddhism. And so this is what Sariputta understood, that for those things which arise because of a cause, the Buddha teaches the cause, and he teaches their cessation. So of the suffering that arises because of fear, the Buddha teaches you about the fear and the ending of that fear. Of the suffering that arises because of greed, the Buddha talks about greed, the cause in greed, and the cessation, the ending of that. So the task is to really see this clearly for ourselves. So Sariputta was, when he saw that possibility, it kind of woke him up. And I'm not saying it's the same thing, but I want to share with you a little moment of kind of waking up that I had on a retreat in Burma. That showed me the power of both the practice of the Buddhism and specifically a practice of mindfulness. So I was contentedly doing walking meditation. Been in a retreat for a while. It was the longest retreat, and I was doing walking meditation. And something inside of me had me appreciate that in the moment of being mindful, there was a kind of freedom in that moment. In mindfulness was strong, and I could just be really present, know this is what's happening, be present, have the knowing of it. There was a way in which I wasn't caught, wasn't entangled. There was a kind of freedom in it, and also a kind of joy. So that kind of was there, kind of that reflection, that understanding arose. And the next thing that arose for me was the understanding or the idea that I can, in theory, be mindful of every experience I have. And so, in theory, it's possible to be free in every experience that I have. And then I got really happy. It wasn't like I could do it just like that easily, just because I saw it. But wow, I knew something. I knew a possibility of freedom. I knew a path. I knew a way. Oh, it's possible. And and then I kind of wasn't so mindful anymore because I was so happy. So the dependent origination is usually talked about in two different ways. One way is as a principle, and then some people associate with what Sally's going to talk about in a few talks from now, which is the chain of dependent origination. It's a 12-fold chain. And this 12-fold chain is the application of the principle. So the principle is that, to say it maybe in, you know, kind of unspiritual terms, there is X. X originates from Y. With the seizing of Y, X seizes as well. If there is something, and its existence is depending on something else, if that something else ends, the first thing ends. So I admit that, you know, don't push the analogy too much, but the rain is dependent on the clouds. The clouds go away, and there's no more rain. So that's the principle of dependent origination. And in the passage 29, there's one of these versions of this principle. When this is, that is. From the arising of this comes the rising of that. When this isn't, that isn't. From the stopping of this comes the stopping of that. So this is the principles of dependent arising. Dependent means that arises in dependence on something. And arising, the word is actually samuppada, which means, the sum means with. So co-arising. Because some things arise together. Some things clearly follow kind of a chain. One follows the other. So the famous teachings in Buddhism of the Four Noble Truths are an application of this teaching of dependent origination. So the Four Noble Truths is there is suffering and there's a cause or something that arises dependent on. And if that cause or that condition goes away, then that suffering goes away. So if we kind of restate it here, when craving is, suffering is. With the arising of craving comes the arising of suffering. When craving isn't, suffering isn't. From the stopping of craving comes the stopping of suffering. Or to say it in a way that I kind of like, I think it's for me, it kind of has more of an impact or punch. If you cling, you will suffer. If you let go of that clinging, the suffering stops. And I like saying it this way. I like saying it this way, that this principle here is because if you start the way the Four Noble Truths is usually stated, suffering, the origination of it, the origins of it, the cessation of it. Then people say, wait a minute. All suffering comes from craving? I'm sure there's suffering which doesn't come from craving. I think people protest too much. Some people really want their suffering. But if you say it the other way, if you cling, you will suffer. It's hard to argue with that. Maybe there's suffering, other kinds of suffering that doesn't come from clinging. But if you cling, you will suffer. So watch out. So this is supposed to be the good news in Buddhism. And it's supposed to be the alternative towards fixating on things existing in some solid way. Or fixating on things don't exist at all. But rather the focus is on not on whether things exist or doesn't exist. The focus is on understanding how they come to be. And they come to be dependent on conditions. And that gives you a wedge gives you an approach to change the stream of suffering that you have. Part of this theory, I think, goes along with it. It's not stated in the text. And that is that the cause, the condition for suffering is something that's being recreated moment by moment. So it's a little bit different than how it's conventionally understood, where, you know, something happened to me yesterday or 10 years ago. Someone cheated me out of my bank account, and I've been, you know, struggling ever since, and I suffer because of all kinds of reasons because of that. So the condition for my poverty is this guy who took my bank account. That's not going to change. But it isn't, that's considered a supporting condition. The immediate condition that we can have something to do with is how I relate to that situation and my attitude towards it, my reaction to it, my judgments about it, my feelings about it. And those are getting recreated moment by moment. And that's good news as well, because I might not be able to do anything about the lost money 10 years ago. I might not be much to do about my poverty, perhaps. But I can have a lot to do with how I hold that, how I relate to that. And do I hold it with fear? Do I hold it with greed? Do I hold hostility and anger? And that whatever the hostility, the anger, the fear, the greed that still might be operating, the clinging that's there, that's being recreated all the time. And so that's why this thing is good news, because the primary condition for our suffering that we can make a difference with is something that, an activity, a process inside of ourselves that's ongoing. It doesn't justify what happened 10 years ago. It doesn't mean we have to ignore it or, you know, do whatever we need to do. But it's the good news about, can we stop, get quiet enough, or settled enough, focused enough to begin taking greater responsibility and care for this inner life, for the quality of the inner life? Can we begin seeing where the conditions are, what we're doing, what our contribution to it is? What is our contribution to our suffering? And my idea is that if you want to find the Buddhist path of practice, the quickest way to find it is by noticing your contribution to your suffering. Other people might have contributed to it. This is not to deny the fact that you got to take care of other people's, what they're doing to you. But you don't find the Buddhist path there, path of liberation there. You find a mature, maybe you find human maturity in taking care of the things in the world. But if you want to find the path of liberation, the primary place to find it is by looking at your own contribution to your suffering. So someone once said, once you've taken refuge in Buddhism and the Buddha Dharma Sangha, you have no reason anymore to complain. What do you think of that? you can complain about it later if you want. So, and I think the reason for this idea is that because once you really understand this principle of dependent origination and where this, and how it applies to suffering, and how we're supposed to then begin taking responsibility and take and look at our contribution, that becomes the primary kind of, you know, place we find our freedom. So, so one of the ways that people cling, one of the things people cling to, is what Guy talked about this morning, the clinging to self. And it's a very tenacious kind of clinging, because sometimes it's very obvious that holding on tight, but sometimes it's very subtle. So subtle that there are some Buddhist teachers who say, even the very notion, the feeling, the sense of I am involves a very subtle kind of clinging, holding, fixing on something. And so even the sense of I am is a fixation, let alone all the kind of grosser kind of ways we can get attached to self-identity things. And as Guy said so beautifully, you talked about ahamkara and selfing, eye-making and mind-making. These are activities of the mind. If you're involved in an activity of the mind that clings to self, to me, myself, and mine, you will suffer. If you can have a self-identity without acting on it and living in it and and holding on to it, you probably won't suffer. So it's relatively reasonable for me to say that I'm a man. And I don't usually kind of care so much, as far as I can tell. And I don't go around clinging to this guy, you're a man, as far as like, you know, maybe I do, but I don't think about it too much. But it's an identity I have. Sometimes I have to take it into account. Like if I want to go to the bathroom here at Spirit Rock, I think many of you would want me to be clearly aware that I have this identity. Thank you. It's all empty, right? So I can go empty myself anywhere. But it's also possible for me to be completely caught up in being a man and macho and tough and, you know, and I can really hold on to this, or I can be really attached to being the vulnerable and kind guy. And, you know, there's all kinds of ways, right, of being attached to self and, you know, this stuff. That all that is an activity of the mind. You have to do it. Those are things you're doing. And when you start doing, it's good news that you're doing, because you can stop doing. And you can stop doing without needing to debate, is there or is there not a self? Is there or is there not a self is the same as, is there a fist or is there not a fist? Sometimes there is, sometimes there isn't. It depends how you look at it. But the general way in which we see and understand ourselves as a self is an activity. And all activities of the mind can be calmed down. And that's another piece of the good news. You don't have to always be so busy. Nirvana is basically a really good vacation. It's a way of really putting to rest and stopping all that incessant activity. And one of the reasons why Buddhists are so hung up around this thing about self and not self, and really make such an important teaching of it, is because it's one of the primary places where we cling and hold on. And if you get involved in one of philosophically justifying there is a self, or there isn't a self, you're missing the boat. You're missing to look at what's really useful. What's useful to do in terms of liberation is to find the path in yourself, to understand the activities that you do that are the origination, the conditions for the arising of suffering. And if you're clinging to self, you will suffer. If you're clinging to needing to have a belief in a self, you'll suffer. The activity of believing in a self is not needed to become free. The activity of believing that there is no self is not needed to be free. So that's why the Buddha, I believe, said, put aside all the thoughts, all the approaches to understand your life from the point of view of was I, was I not, will I be, who am I not, that I read the other day. And he said, rather, understand it from the point of view of dependent origination. Because then if you start looking at the actual process you're involved in, then you have a chance of getting in there and doing something about it, changing it, shifting it, freeing it. And what I read a few days ago was, instead of all that self kind of analysis, look at suffering, its origination, its cessation, and the way to its cessation. And this is another way of saying dependent origination. Things arise because of conditions. When those conditions are put to rest, then the original thing is put to rest as well. As I look at the teachings of the Buddha in the early texts, he's really concerned, for the most part, with suffering and the end of suffering. And you might think that that's a pretty limited approach to religious life. It encompasses a lot more. But that's kind of the gist of what it's about, because it's so meaningful to help ourselves and other people not to hurt so much. We have a world of people hurt in deep and profound ways. And what is it? How can we really address the deep hurt, the deep suffering that people have that really gets to the root? And so the Buddha, that's what the Buddha was concerned with. How do we get to the root? How do we get to the root? Not to put a bandage over it, and not to give relief to people, but to help people get released from their suffering. So dependent origination is this good news that the Buddha offered for this purpose. It means you're suffering, you're not stuck in suffering. There's a practice to be done that helps you get underneath the suffering to the conditions out of which it arises and change those conditions. So I said this, but the emphasis is suffering, because sometimes people will take the teachings of dependent origination and want to apply it to everything. Kind of like a Buddhist physics. That everything is dependently origin. And I think that's pretty much the case. It's a fine belief to have. But I think we get sidetracked a little bit too much into philosophy. As I understand it, the point of these teachings is to help be a mirror so that we're willing to do the deeper work of looking more carefully, getting quiet enough, still enough, concentrated enough, so that we can see our contribution. What are we doing that's a condition for why we suffer, why we... And so the teachings on emptiness and dependent origination being closely connected is also means that nothing in the world of our suffering is fixed and solid. It's all changing. And it's all changeable depending on the conditions that are in place. All the things that we see in the world around us are impermanent and are constantly changing. And they, in their own way, are empty of lasting existence. And therefore, they don't qualify as something that's useful to cling to, because it's like clinging to water. The water just runs out through your hands as you form a fist. So perhaps this Dharma door is meaningful for some of you. And perhaps like Sariputta, who heard it and kind of was pretty impressed by it. Maybe if you really think about it and take it in and consider it, maybe you'll be impressed. Maybe it's meaningful for you. And one way to consider it that maybe it can maybe help you understand the impact of it is to not go into abstraction, not go into thinking a lot about it, but appreciate what happens in the immediacy of the present moment. And that there's some way of seeing in the immediacy of the present moment what's happening and your relationship to what's happening. And that in your relationship to what's happening, you can find this whole dependent origination. Whether dependent origination is something that's ultimately philosophically, you know, valid in all possible directions isn't as interesting as in the immediacy of your life. There's what's happening and there's a relationship to what's happening. That relationship is a condition for something else, and that relationship arises out of other conditions. And if you appreciate the conditioned nature of that, how things arise because of conditions, and that the conditions are not fixed, that then there's a possibility of being free in any situation you find yourself in. Any moment, any time that's here and now. But if you don't get close to the present and stay in abstractions about it all, I don't think dependent origination is going to have much meaning, unless it's just a nice philosophical idea. So if you take it in and consider this teaching, you might try to consider it from that perspective of the immediacy of now. What's happening now? What's happening and what's your relationship to it? So there are more readings in the study guide on this section. Then you can leave that to you to read if you'd like. I think hopefully the talk kind of sets up the readings so they make a little more sense than they would otherwise. So let's take a few minutes to sit and recollect. So the Buddha was supposed to have said, one who sees dependent arising sees the Dhamma. One who sees the Dhamma sees dependent origination.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up now that spring is here, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. So what's the right amount of socializing for you? Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. It's a great way to build relationship skills, figure out your goals, and so much more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/beherenow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/beherenow.